call the meeting of the Historic Preservation Commission to order, March 20th, 2023. And shall we do the Pledge of Allegiance? I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. And would you do the roll call, please?
Commissioner Vilander.
Present.
Commissioner Velez.
Present.
Vice Chair McDevitt.
Present.
Chair Murray.
Present.
And Commissioner Dubé.
Present.
At this time, advise that the public is time, if someone would like to address the commission regarding an item that is not an agenda, but within the subject matter jurisdiction of the commission. Anybody in person? Is any speaker slip?
I do not have any speaker slips, but if there are any members of the Zoom webinar who wish to speak, please raise your hand and I will call on you. And I do not see any raised hands at this time.
All right. So moving on to amendments or adjustments to the agenda. Anything
we
to
do
amend? Ms. Brasi.
Chair Murray. We do not have any adjustments or amendments today.
Okay, thank you. And so, Clerk, would you read the first item on the record?
That is item A1, discussion regarding the provisions of Chapter 17.33 of the Goleta Municipal Code regarding historic resources and the adopted review standards and procedures.
So before we ask Ms. Brasi to begin, I wanted to ask if there's a preference in the commissioners whether would you like Ms. Brasi to go present the whole entire report and then we ask questions, or would you like to have each section presented and then we ask questions for each section? I was wanting to see the pleasure of the commission.
I would say by section.
Mm-hmm. By section?
Yes, by section.
By section sounds good.
Okay. Ms. Brasi.
Okay.
Yeah, that'd be good.
Then we can do that.
All right.
So good evening. I'm Lisa Prossy, I'm current planning manager, and unfortunately Daryl Mimic is not able to be here this evening, so you have me. How do I get? Okay. Anyway. Okay. Got it to move. So we thought it would be good for the commission to, if we walk through what's in the two different sections in the municipal code that are within your, pretty much your primary purview, that will be the items that will be coming before you over the course of, you know, your tenure. And just as Daryl mentioned, or Mr. Mimic mentioned, you know, it was 6 years in the making. The ordinance, and so we really wanted to share with you, you know, what the provisions are, and know that it's a work in progress. So, you know, as things, as we use it, we'll probably see that things need to be tweaked. And I think as staff and as you work with it, you know, let us know what you think needs to be modified. Our advanced planning team modifies the code about once a year. So once we identify something that needs to be changed, we can share it with them and, you know, get it into the schedule. In fact, as I was preparing for this, I realized there's something I already need to suggest. So just know that things like that happen. So we just wanted to share with you, like I said, go a little deeper, answer any questions you have. And, you know, we're not asking for any decisions at all tonight, but just really to help you all get an understanding, and us as well. Okay, so the review process. So, and I should back up. So as Daryl shared with you before, you know, the ordinance got adopted about a year ago, and the ordinance had different, first we had, I don't know if you're familiar with the Goleta Municipal Code mm-hmm. at all. We have 17 chapters in the Goleta Municipal Code. Like the first one is about Title one is administration. Title two sets up like city council, city manager, and all of the commissions. And so you will find some of your responsibilities outlined in Title two. You're the very last section because you're the last one that we just added to Title II. And then the other titles, there's things like business licenses, I think it's in Title V, and I think our purchasing procedures are in Title III, Title 10 and 12 and are usually like public works types of things. 15 has a building code, I know that. 16 has a subdivision code, and then Title 17 is the zoning code, which is primarily what most of the planning department, where most of our regulations live. So the historic preservation portion of the ordinance got incorporated in as the 33rd chapter in Title 17, it's 17.33. And the archaeological and tribal cultural section got it incorporated in as 17.43. Mm-hmm. So you'll see us bounce between those two sections. So the first, one of the first sections in 1733 deals with historic resources inventory. And that is our primary list of historic resources. And currently we have about 30 structures that are on our historic resources inventory. Anything that's going to be deemed historic is going to be on our historic resources inventory. Now, things, and we'll talk in a little bit, we can have specializations within that historic resources inventory. And in fact, we now have 7 properties that are deemed historic landmarks that the council adopted. But to be on the historic landmark, you first have to be on the historic, not first, but you need to be on the historic mm-hmm. resources inventory. So as this slide shows, and if you want to go back and look at the code section, it's 17.33.030 is where the historic resource inventory provisions are located. And pretty much it's any building, structure, object, or site that meets one of the following criteria, which we've got listed, that it's identified to be eligible through a historic resources survey, and that would need to be prepared by a professional, or was eligible or listed on the National Register, on the State Register, and that can be either specifically or as a contributor through a historic district, or was designated by the County of Santa Barbara, and then things that are designated by the City Council. And the process, this is something that the City Council would determine to be, you know, to add to the register. And pretty much that's the criteria is one of these things. It's primarily going to be, if it's over 50 years old, pretty much, based on the recommendation from a preservation specialist to be on the historic resources inventory. And what's important is that, you know, to the historic resources inventory is used for the determination of whether or not the property should be designated as a landmark or added to a historic district. And anything that's on the historic resources inventory is subject to the standards and the review processes outlined within the ordinance. So alterations, demolitions, and including covered for CEQA. So that, you know, being on the historic resources inventory, you know, pretty much gives all the protections that we would want, you know, for a historic resource. The only thing that if you're on the historic resource but not designated a landmark, the only thing you're not eligible for is Mills Act. But using the historic building code and any of the other specialized things you can do as being on a historic inventory, you know, they are subject to that. So this does give the, you know, the protection that we, you know, was one of the goals of the whole project. So, I covered that on the second slide. I don't know at this point if we have any questions you want to go into depth a little bit more, or I'm happy to entertain a discussion.
I have several questions, but let's start with Commissioner Dubé.
So for, do we have like structures of merit? Is there any other designation other than landmark or on the historic resources inventory for a property?
For an individual property, well, we also have historical places of interest, points of interest, but that's about it. We talked about that a lot, but we felt the determination was that most of our properties would either fit on the historic resources inventory, and if they were really warranting it to be a landmark.
So I have several questions. So how do you get a new resource into the inventory list? What is the procedure for that?
Someone would make an application for that. And this is where I said we already identified we need to make a change. The code, it just says that it's up to City Council. It would need to go to City Council. I'm pretty sure they would want to get your input before they did that. So it would be similar to what we would do for a landmark in terms of the review process of submitting an application, having it reviewed by you, and then going to City Council. Mm-hmm. And Council would adopt it by resolution, and we would add it to the list.
So let me ask this. Do we have an application form for, let's say someone wants to put a resource on an inventory list that is not already part of the 2930 buildings, how do they go about that? Because I was reading the ordinance, and it says, well, any resident in the city can do this, but it didn't specify inventory resources. It talked about becoming a landmark or something. So I wanted to see if that can be sort of checked to be sure that anyone who has a building that is meets the criteria but is not included in the 30 structures should be open to that. For example, there is a property at 469 Kellogg Way. It's a carpenter's Gothic. It's from 1896. The house, it belongs to the Beck family, very important family in Goleta. Mm-hmm. Their land was all the 10 acres, 25 acres where the community center is. That is not a part of the inventory list that we have. And yet, I just went by, the building is pretty much intact. So I was just wondering just raising the question if we wanted to include that. Obviously, we have to talk to the owners and so forth, but it has been recognized for a long, long time as a very important building. It's one of these Gothic, mm-hmm. cross cable, high cables. And So anyway, that's just one example. So I think what I would really, as we move forward, is to find a way where resources can be added to the historic resources inventory list. For example, we could do that in a year and then combine them and go bring it to the council for approval or something. So
yes, the idea is, yes, there would be an application form. We have a common application form. So all of our applications get submitted pretty much with one application form, but the checklist that goes with each type of application is different. So, and yes, we would have one, I think we have one, for historic resources inventory. I know we have one for the landmarks and the other applications. So that would be, yes.
Okay. I have a question too that, okay. So as far as the role of the commission, I think there may be a conflict if one of the commissioners decides to, you know, fill out an application for a property. So how should we go about that? I would think we're the ones that are making decisions on properties rather than actually filling out applications. Do you have any guidance on how to make sure that we are navigating that properly, not getting into sticky situations?
That is a very good question. Okay. And we probably should invite our city attorney to come and okay. speak and have you. I mean, I think you will be invited to, we typically have training on conflicts of interest mm-hmm. and Brown Act once every year, 2 years. I'm looking at you, but you've been at the city like
5 months.
5 months. So okay. We have those periodically. And for sure, we'll have that conversation. If you're going to, as a review body, you need to avoid the appearance of a conflict. Right. You need and potentially a direct conflict. I know enough to know that you need to talk to the city attorney about when you think okay. you have a conflict. Yep. Basically, if you see something that's coming before you, which I know this. Like if you see something that's coming before you and you either own property or your business mm-hmm. is located within 500 feet of that, you are deemed to have a conflict and you shouldn't participate. Now, and if you're over 1,000 feet away, there is no conflict. And that 500 to 1,000 is a gray area, and mm-hmm. that's where you definitely need to talk to the city attorney's office. There's also, if you see somebody or something's coming to you and that person's a client of yours or has been a client of yours and I think it's 12 months, there's a certain threshold and I think it's within 12 months, then also, you know, you have a conflict. But the specific conflict questions should go to the city attorney, Winnie Kai. And yep. if you don't have her email address, we can make sure we send that to you. In terms, and it probably would be wise for the commission not to be actively engaged in generating applications, primarily because you are going to be looking at them,
right.
and you can, but then know that you'd have to step down.
Yeah, recuse yourself from just that one.
Yes.
Topic.
Yep. Yes. Okay. So. And in terms, and just coming back to historic resources inventory, well, and pretty much all of the application types we're going to talk about, you know, the role of the commission is to make a recommendation on either to the city council or the planning commission or the design review board. So your recommendations are going to go multiple places.
Mm-hmm.
And I know people are excited to hear what you have to say about different projects. So
if you don't mind, let's just go back and just make sure I understand this. So let's say, I mean, because I know the city, there's so many other resources that really should be into the inventory list. Is that something that we cannot get involved in as commissioners, or is that something that we could just recommend it to you, the staff, and say, oh, we know these resources. Can they be checked out? Who does that? And then we're basically recommending, we think these are four resources or five that should be included in the inventory list, and these are the reasons why. Do we just recommend that to you, to the staff, and then, because we don't want to recuse, I don't want to recuse myself for recommending mm-hmm. something good for the city, and I also definitely want to be sure the property owners are on board and wanting to do this. This is very important.
Yeah.
So it's that line where.
You know, that's a really good question, and I feel like I need to defer and talk with the city attorney about that.
Yeah.
Because I can see it going both ways, and I think that's a question that we need to get some legal counsel on.
I'm thinking, and I totally understand what Chair Murray is saying, because that's why we're involved on this, right, is because we want to preserve mm-hmm. and protect. But I do know that, you know, allowing the planning process to, make its way, any kind of project on within city limits is going to be, subject to consideration by the city, right? And so then you have planners that are going to have to look at this, and they'll determine that the property, they have to look at it and determine that the property is, or the structure is 50 years or older, right? Or actually 45 or older. And then that's when they would, if it's of that age, they would then go and tell the applicant that they need to retain an architectural historian in order to make that determination. And then eventually I would think it would come back to us.
Yeah.
So without our involvement, although that takes patience.
Yes.
Eventually, I think it will come to us, especially with this ordinance.
Yeah, but on the other hand, it means you're waiting for a project. And you mm-hmm. say 10 years, there's no mm-hmm. project. Those resources are just there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That's
yeah,
what
I understand.
Was,
yeah, I understand.
Like this house that I was talking about. I mean, there's nothing's going to happen. There's no project. I'm just saying.
Yeah.
Anyway, so it's a dicey situation.
Right, and I think we need to get some.
Clear from the attorney.
Chair Murray?
Oh.
Please.
How often are the inventories done? Are they done annually, every 2 years, every 5 years?
We could amend the inventory whenever somebody proposed to make an addition to it. There's no, we haven't looked at creating a certain time period to like every few years, go do another survey and see if there's additional properties.
Mm-hmm.
That is something we could add to our work plan to see if that is something council is interested in, and the current planning department's work plan. You know, we're still trying to finish, get you guys up and running, get the ordinance adopted, get this up and running. So I'm glad you're thinking ahead. So food for thought for next year or the year after.
Yeah. That's a really good thought, because
yeah.
planning is good, and we can just put it out there, see, not next year, but maybe 2 years from now, have some budget for a survey, and that would be done independently by somebody
mm-hmm. yeah.
instead of us, and that way it's...
Right.
Yeah.
Because what I could see happening is that the council allocates funds to have a survey done that consultant firm does the windshield survey again, like we did with the historic preservation ordinance. They develop a list of, yes, we think these properties meet the criteria, and then we could come to you as a body to review it and see if you agree, and then we could go on to council with, seeing if there was additions. I could see that happening.
Yeah.
Is there the possibility of doing a little PR within the community and saying this process is there, these applications are available, just sort of an FYI to the community that it's available?
There is, and it is definitely one of the things we still are trying to roll out. Yes. Yes, and I know this is a big aside. I know you all have provided bios, and we are going to use those. Um, our our community relations department function. Probably you'll see a story in the Monarch Press. So that'll help with the PR and get things going. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if there are any more commission questions on this topic. I don't know if you want to see if there's community.
Is there any questions?
I don't have any speakers here in person, but if there are any members of the Zoom webinar who wish to speak, please raise your hand and we will call on you. And I'm not seeing any hands raised at this time.
Okay. Moving on.
Okay, moving on. So that's historic resources inventory. So then the next criteria, so anything that we've got designated is on the historic resources inventory. So then we have a historic landmark designation, and the criteria is that it is at least 50 years old and exhibits exceptional importance, and it meets one of the following criteria: that it's associated with important events, persons of historic significance, or embodies distinctive characteristics. And also that the proposed site retains those aspects of historic integrity that conveys the reasons for its significance. Okay, so, and in this instance, this is one where definitely we have the historic designation of a landmark is in 17.33040B, has the whole, the process for designating a historic landmark with about an application form or an application, which can be initiated by any resident of the city. It does not have to be the property owner. If it is not the property owner, then within 10 days of us receiving the application, we will notify the property owner that their property has been submitted for nomination. And then during that, so then the idea is that staff will review the application, see if it meets the criteria. We'll probably engage with a third party, historian, just to, because some of us like historic preservation on staff, but we're not, we don't have the right criteria or the, expertise to get their input. And then we have 90 days to once an application is deemed complete, we will be scheduling it for your review within 90 days of us deeming the application complete. And that way, and then you will be reviewing it, and it will be at a public hearing like this. We'd notify the neighbors and we'd notify, the property owner. And then you would make a recommendation, and then it would go on to the city council. The city council, hopefully their public hearing would happen shortly after yours hearing, but we've given ourselves another 90 days, so a total of 180 days, because we know that council agendas can get heavily impacted, or it's summer and they only meet once a month in the summer months. But anyway, we are giving so from the time an application is deemed complete to when it can get to council, we hope to have that process completed within 180 days. If for some reason council can't act on it within 180 days. Then the project would be deemed automatically denied, but denied without prejudice, meaning that, they could reapply, or whoever, submitted it could reapply the application. And then once council were to approve the landmark designation, then we'd send a notice to both the applicant and the property owner. So that is kind of the overview. I know it's probably really hard to read on that screen up there, maybe in front of you. Mm-hmm. We have a flow chart of basically what I just talked about in terms of the process. I also, we attached it as attachment 2 We have a flow chart for each of the application types. So hopefully it's clear. And if you see something that doesn't make sense, let me know. And we've, you know, obviously, like I said, we're trying to make sure we get these things dialed in. So that covers my presentation on this topic. So I don't know, Chair Murray, if there are questions of the commission.
Any questions from the commission?
Nope.
No questions.
And if there are any members of the Zoom webinar who wish to speak, please raise your hand and I will call on you. We have no public comment at this time.
So, and I guess one other thing I should mention is that there is a process if for some reason something needs to be amended or we need to rescind it, there's also a process spelled out in the ordinance how to do it. And it's pretty much the same. You know, just rewind. Mm-hmm. But it is pretty much the same.
Oh, so I have one question concerning the landmarks. So I was reading one of our purposes is to educate educate the public about our historic heritage. And now, with this already designated landmark, is that something that we can put out for education, like in the Monarch or something, like maybe in during the Preservation Month, feature one of them or seven of them? Because, you know, a lot of people don't really know a lot about these resources and what they are. Anyway, just thinking about that.
Yeah, that's a great idea. Yeah, we can totally do that. Okay, so then
moving on
to the historic district designation. So this like if there's a significant concentration of properties that are united, you know, historically, aesthetically, or a physical development, like a subdivision that, you know, the homes, it was one subdivision, and the homes, you know, the 50s had a lot of things like mm-hmm. Eichlers, and, you know, if there's something that, you know, still has that same characteristics together, that there's a minimum of 60% of the properties are identified as a contributor, and that the district collectively retains those aspects that makes it significant, you know, that conveys the reason for the significance. The one thing is that we would need to do a historic district. We need the historic district needs to be initiated by a resident of the city, that it's that the time of the nomination is submitted, that the applicant submits documentation by letter or by petition, that is a minimum of 51% of the property owners within the proposed district. So it doesn't need to be unanimous, but we just want 51% of the area that is proposed to be a district to sign on to the application. And again, we go through the process of notifying all the property owners within 10 days that we've taken it in. We do the same that, you know, we have to bring the item before you within 90 days of us deeming the application complete, and then it would go on to the city council within 180 days. So it's pretty much, we kind of dialed into the same process. And the one thing I should have mentioned on the landmarking is that no on-site activities other than routine maintenance is supposed to occur, that way to prevent people doing unauthorized mm-hmm. additions or subtractions from properties during that time period. So again, here is the flow chart that shows how the process is supposed to work.
Are there any questions from the commissioner debate?
Are there any current historic districts in the city of Goleta? I didn't see any on the historic resources inventory.
We do not okay. at this point, but we think there's probably probably somebody would need to spend some time to figure out a small enough area mm-hmm. Or a large enough area, however you want to. I think we'd probably, if someone were to spend some time about looking at it, there's probably
a couple of eligible ones.
But yeah. When we were doing the project, we wanted to get the framework in place and then, you know, think about that.
Go ahead.
I don't mean to nitpick. So on this deck, it says a minimum of 60% of the properties are identified as contributors.
Yes.
And then I notice it does say 51% on the decision chart.
The owners. Those are owners.
Owners.
So
owners.
So what, I just want to clarify, what's the difference between
the 60%?
60% versus the 51.
Well, the 51% is that 51% of the property owners need to agree to being, agreeing to submit the application.
Versus 60% of the properties.
Properties having some, either being historic or contributing to the historic nature of the district that's being proposed, okay, whether that's size, bulk, scale, architectural features. You know, not everything in that district might be, you know, historic, but it might support it and be a contributor.
Okay, thank you.
So that's the difference.
So I have several questions and comments about this. This is really important. Yes, in the historical context, actually three areas were identified as potential historic districts, and one of them is the so El Encanto Heights, Lake Los Carneros North, and Kellogg Park. And while the survey was a windshield survey, and they surveyed the area, and they said, okay, they even named some of the contributors and also as non-contributors. But I have walked those neighborhoods, and there are definitely some intact enclaves of those neighborhoods, that I really think they really should be historic districts before they're gone, at least in these three areas. I have not really walked the other areas, but they are just some of the best mid-century architecture in California. Mm-hmm. And so I was wondering, Lisa, I'm sorry, Ms. Brasi, what is the best way to sort of, the process of, I think we'll have to talk to the lawyer again, educating ourselves on how to bring attention to them without seeming to be authoritative about it, so to speak. But I just think I would just love to see some of our education in the newsletter or something, to feature a walking tour or something about this these buildings, so people come to really realize the value. And who knows, some of those owners may want to do, hey, this is really going to heighten the value of our homes, and maybe we want to do this. That's exactly what happened to Old Town. People used to call Old Town a blighted area, and we went there and we checked it out. No, it's not blighted area. As a fact, all these resources are there. I'm thinking that is the spirit that could be. But these historic districts are just dicey to begin with, because you need that. But I think a small enclave could really work, especially if of course you have to have the, you know, 51% and 60%. You can easily get 60%. You're talking about five houses or six houses, mm-hmm, or whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, it's no. Anyway, I just want to put it out there, because I'd be happy to take anybody on a walking tour of these neighborhoods. So there are three main ones. So the Kellogg Park, these are all from the 1957. 1958, and Lake Los Carneros North has got some really wonderful ones. Anyway, so thank you.
Sure. Chair Murray, I don't know if others have questions or comments.
No, I don't.
So that's historic districts. So then the next one, we have a points of historical interest. So, and this is, these are sites that are associated with historic events or important persons, but otherwise the building or object no longer exists. And they can be sites of historic events which has no distinguishable physical characteristics. So, This could be like the railroad cut, mm-hmm, you know, that, or the bombing the Japanese bombing during World War II. Those are the types of things that would fall into this points of historical interest. And I don't think we, I have to go back and look. I don't think we designated any when we did the adoption last year, but those would be prime candidates to for someone to write up the nomination form and come through. And then, so I think we do have a spreadsheet for this, but it, or a spreadsheet, a flow chart for it, but it's the same process. Someone would make the application, and you know, your recommendation on to city council. So those are the types of designations we have. And like I mentioned before, you know, we have 30 properties that are on currently on the historic resources inventory. And then we have 7 properties that have been designated as historic landmarks. So then some of the other interesting thing or things that got adopted. One is the Mills Act program. I don't know how many of you are familiar with that, but it's a tax rebate type of program where if a property owner who has a historic landmark or a contributor within a historic district can apply for a Mills Act contract. And what they do, it's similar to a Williamson Ag contract where they enter into this agreement that's 10 years long, and it's an evergreen 10 years. So on the date of renewal, it renews for another year. Now, on that renewal date, they could opt to come out of the contract, and then it winds down for the next 10 years. And what it does is it substantially reduces the property taxes on the property. And the idea is that that property tax that you're saving then gets rolled back into the property used to, you know, do maintenance or improve it. It's a preservation tool. And this is totally, you know, optional for the property owner to apply for, and it's also totally optional if the council wants to approve it or not. We have the tool. We wanted to make sure we had the preservation tool available, that if somebody wanted and needed it, that it was available. And, you know, the property tax, I think it's something like it can reduce it by, like, I think almost half. It's substantial. And the idea is that they come up with a schedule of what they're going to do, you know, whether it's replacing the windows or replacing the floor or, you know, getting a new roof on the building or, you know, and when placing the windows, it would be replacing the windows with something that's appropriate, not going to aluminum sliders, but going to something, unless that was part of the historic charm, integrity. But, you know, going, you know, doing something that is appropriate for the style and the time period. So,
are there any questions from the commission?
So how do they apply for that?
There's an application form. We actually have somebody that's expressed interest, but they want to wait and see if we're, we have a, the one thing we didn't do, we didn't think about, was established when we went last year for council adoption, was determining what kind of review fees, if anything at all, for these application types. So I know one person was like, I'm going to hold off until I see what council decides to do. And hopefully I have turned in a proposal to the finance department because they do our fee update every year, which I think is like either in April or May, probably at May at this point, and they'll, you know, take it forward to council and see what the outcome is. So
are there any other questions? I have one question. So if you're on the inventory list and you want to have the Mills Act, since you are not entitled to it, you'll have to then apply for a landmark status.
Yes.
And then you get approved for that, and then you then apply for the Mills Act if you get approved by the land, become a landmark.
Yes, you could do, they can do it concurrently. So, you know, the request could, yeah, could come before you and come into staff as I want to be designated a landmark and I also want to request a Mills Act. And we would take both. Yeah, we're good at you know, consolidating.
Okay. Thank you. Do you?
And if there are any members of the public who wish to speak on this, please raise your hand and I will call on you. And I have no public speakers at this time.
Okay. So there's the flow chart. So alterations to historic resources. This is this one I think we're going to probably, you know, I think this will be the one where you see we'll get a lot of applications. I mean, we do only have 30 properties, but I think this is, like I said, I think maybe the bulk of what we're going to have on your agenda. So if somebody has a designated historic resource, and they want to make changes to it, and including maybe relocating it, whether either on their existing property or somewhere else in the city, you know, that request will come before this commission. And what will happen is that you will review it, you will make a recommendation, and in this case, it will go on to the design review board because they actually will make the decision about whether or not to grant, if it's strictly just making an alteration to an existing historic structure, then that would go on to the design review board and they would make the decision based on their criteria plus the criteria that we've outlined in the historic preservation ordinance. There are specific findings, but you get to make that the first cut at making those findings. So, basically, it would be reviewing it if it's consistent with the applicable design guidelines and standards, or in the absence of design guidelines, if the alteration, and I just saw that we have a typo in there, consistent with the relevant Secretary of Interior standards for the treatment of historic properties, or if there's sufficient evidence that the denial of the alteration would provide a hardship. And then here's, yeah. So there are some exemptions of what would need to come before the Historic Preservation Commission and or the Design Review Board. It's things like if somebody is re-roofing the historic structure and they're coming in with something that's pretty consistent with what is there, well, maybe not, what should be there for historic structure. You know, things like that. The director can decide that, you know, it's compatible. But, I mean, if it isn't, then we will be going through the review process as outlined. And are you all pretty familiar with the Secretary of Interior standards?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Kind of. We can get more info. Do you want to give any questions from the commission?
And if there are any members of the public who wish to speak, please raise your hand and I'll call on you. And I have no public speakers at this time.
Okay, and then here is the flow chart that we have. And if anybody is watching, we do have this up on the city website on the planning webpage where the applications are. All of the information we have on our historic preservation program and these flowcharts and application the application checklists are on that page. Okay, so demolition. In the unfortunate event somebody wants to demolish a historic structure, that requires a conditional use permit. We aren't just don't want that to happen, you know, without a real serious review of such a request. And that would be the Planning Commission would be the one to make a decision on that. So And again, the Historic Preservation Commission would definitely get an opportunity to review it and weigh in and decide if the demolition request, sorry, was warranted. So, you know, the findings would be that the demolition request is consistent with the intent of the ordinance and the policies within the general plan, which is a pretty high bar, that if there's environmental impacts, that those are mitigated, that the demolition would not have a negative effect on the ordinance, and that one of the following, you know, five findings, that the negative effects outweigh the benefits, that retaining it, there's no economic use, and, oh, it retains no economic use, sorry, and the retention would cause a hardship, relocation is infeasible, and it's necessary to protect the health, safety, and welfare of the community. So, and again, here's the flow chart for demolition of a historic resource, which we hope we never have to follow, but you never know. So, I don't know, are there any questions?
Any questions?
Any members of the public wishing to speak, please raise your hand. No speakers at this time.
So, I just want to say that we tried to make it so that it was serious enough so people wouldn't want to demolish, you know, pursue demolition, but at the same time realizing that there sometimes there are situations when it might be warranted. And adaptive reuse and relocation are always the first choice. And so I think that concludes the presentation, kind of going through the historic resources ordinance. I don't know if there are additional questions, thoughts.
Is it possible to take a quick break before the next item?
Sure.
Just stretch our mm-hmm. Is that okay, commissioners? Yeah?
Yes.
Yeah. 5 minutes?
Sure. It's
all right.
Yeah.
That is item A2, receive a presentation on the provisions of chapter 17.43 of the Goleta Municipal Code regarding archaeological and tribal cultural resources and allow public comments.
Is there any announcements by members?
No.
Okay.
Oh, no.
No.
Yeah.
That's it.
No, we're not there yet. We're not there yet. Okay. As I mentioned before, you know, the ordinance, we also added chapter 17.43, which is where the archaeological and tribal cultural resources provisions exist. And I'm pretty proud of this section because this is really unique. Not many jurisdictions have this. Because I know this because when I tried to do research to try to start crafting this, I think I found 3 counties and maybe 1 city. And even 1 city like Ojai, they didn't adopt it as an ordinance. They only adopted their standards by resolution and as guidelines. So this is pretty unique that we have this. Mm-hmm. So, and I think it's working pretty well after about a year of implementation. So as we shared before, you know, I know you all realize, you know, Goleta is a very special place, especially when it comes to Native American resources. You know, we've had Native Americans living here. We're on their land, you know, thousands of years. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there was at least 2 villages here in Goleta. And, you know, it's unfortunate that the people in, things got lost, mm-hmm. And didn't get treated with the care that it deserved. Mm-hmm. And I'm proud that we were able, I'm really happy that we were able to create an ordinance, I think, that at least starts to recognize that. I don't know if Commissioner Velez wants, anyway, our purpose and intent was to recognize that, mm-hmm. that, you know, Goleta is a unique place, that there is a cultural character and integrity that needs to be recognized, and trying to protect that and enhance that, and to foster awareness. Mm-hmm. Anyway, that was the purpose and intent, and so we created a path that where we, you know, set up where some ground-disturbing activities could be considered exempt, but other ground-disturbing activities would be non-exempt. And for a while, and I don't know if Commissioner McDaniel did it, mm-hmm. remember, I know she mm-hmm. was involved in Commissioner, yeah. Chair Murray was, I keep wanting to say Chair Firmina.
It's okay.
We started off thinking we would just like start with, okay, if you're within 500 feet of a known archaeological mm-hmm. site, we would say that's what you needed to protect. But then we were like, well, but if someone wanted to come build a swimming pool that's 1,000 feet away, why would we not want to look at what they're doing? Mm-hmm. So we just kind of changed the idea from what we know, because what we don't know, we don't know. Mm-hmm. And so that was kind of the guiding idea behind the ordinance. What we don't know, but we want to try to figure it out. So anyway, our mindset switched to what is native soil, and what that means is soil that has not been disturbed in the past. Mm-hmm. Because if it's already been disturbed, yeah, unfortunately, if there was something there, it's not going to be there. So that's why the ordinance is focused on what's on native soil and disturbing native soil. And these list of things that are exempt typically won't disturb native soil or are already occurring in previously disturbed soils. So that's how we got to the non-exempt or the exempt. And then if it wasn't exempt, then it became non-exempt, and then there's a whole process, and I'll talk about that. So the exempt development is anything that doesn't require a building permit, which typically means things like
gardening.
Pardon?
Gardening. And
yeah, gardening, a shed. Mm-hmm. You know, the building code has a list of about 15 things that they don't require building permits for. And so, you know, someone putting in a new driveway, which, you know, really they're only going to go down like 4 to 6 inches. Mm-hmm. So things like that. Any earth disturbing activities affecting, it's supposed to be 4 cubic feet or less. So that's pretty much like a 2x2 mm-hmm. or 4 square feet. Anyway,
so
it was
not,
like a
it's
two
not
by,
depth.
Well, yeah, I think it's, yeah, it was depth. It's supposed to be 4 cubic feet.
Yeah.
Earth disturbing activities within previously documented areas, and not to a greater in depth than the previous disturbance. So if we know an area has been graded before and we know that it's gone down like four, you know, somebody had mass graded it, scraped off, you know, 4 feet or 6 feet, then compacted it and then put fill on top, we know, you know, like there's not going to be any resources really in that area. And then like alterations, you know, we were just covering the bases, alterations to existing structures, you know, interior alterations, planting of trees, and then unfortunately, if we have an earth disturbing activity, though, things like an emergency project, we need, you know, if someone needed to get in and fix a storm drain pipe that's burst or a water line or a sewer line, We'll take the chance. We're sorry, but, you know, that type of thing, you know, would need to be done. Now, that's only in an emergency. If somebody was planning it, we would want them to, use the care. And then we have a whole other process. If we have a known, either what we call a preliminary archaeological assessment or a previous phase one that was done within the past 5 years, we would be willing to use that as documentation. And the idea is that the reports prepared within the past 5 years have been done to a standard that would be acceptable and not just blowing off that there could be resources there. Sorry, I know that's not the technical way of saying it, but
it gets the job done.
Now, so non-exempt development would be anything that wasn't in the exempt category. So basically any earth disturbing activities of any size that we know or propose to occur within any area of a documented archaeological or tribal cultural identified area. Earth disturbing activities of more than 4 cubic feet of native soil where we don't have documentation that would warrant, that wouldn't determine it to make it exempt. I will say, like, how to determine what's documented was a source of a lot of discussion. And, you know, we're trying to do the best we can with the records we have. The county either didn't keep them or, anyway, they swear they shared everything with us. Maybe they did. You know, we have what we have. And we're trying to work with what we have. So here's the initial project review. So the first question that we have is, I know that's really hard to read, you know, is it going to create an earth disturbing activity? No? Okay, we're done. If it does, then we look at the exempt line. If it fits the exemption, then we're done. If it does, if it's non-exempt, then the person or the applicant is either going to prepare what's called a preliminary archaeological assessment, which they would contact a local archaeologist who would do a record search. We are not, if it's something like it's pretty minimal, we would have them prepare a report, which is a preliminary archaeological assessment, and I'm sure Commissioner McDaniel Divick could share more what that involves. But if it's something that is like vacant land, we would have them do a phase one or an extended phase one. And an extended phase one is actually test pits. Mm-hmm. So that's the initial. And then, if we have a PAA, I'm just going to call it that. So it's when it's located in a paved area, a developed area, or a landscaped area. And then a phase one is when it's not paved, developed, or landscaped. And then the extended phase one is when we think the presence of resources, there could be the presence of resources. And then we would want a Chumash monitor when that work is occurring. So here is the flow chart about a PAA. And pretty much if it doesn't need any further archaeological or tribal cultural resource studies needed, then the project could proceed on with what we call a zoning clearance, which is one of our standard applications. And then here are the permit requirements. If after getting the reports, or even if we require a phase one report, it is going to kick it up to a minor conditional use permit, which is a review by the Planning Commission with notice, public hearing, and all of the associated review that goes with that. And primarily that's to make sure that we have the documentation and properly done and that the public has an opportunity to weigh in. And then here is the flow chart for either a phase one or extended phase one. And, oh, I should have stopped. Well, maybe, why don't I stop here? Sorry, I was just going on, and then we can talk about our standards.
Are there any questions from the commission? I have a couple of questions. Mm-hmm. Go ahead. Anybody else have a question?
I would say I do have some idea, not that we need to tackle this now.
Okay.
But I do see some areas where there may be issues with that process from an archaeologist.
Right.
That might hinder the proper evaluation because it jumps to an extended phase one very quickly.
Okay.
Doesn't allow for other possibilities without doing extended phase one because that's not always what's required.
Okay.
But I think, I mean, it's awesome. I think I'm so glad that you guys did this. It really is terrific. Just like you said, it is unique. Not a lot of municipalities have something like this. So. But, I mean, you just don't know until you start practicing these, right? So, but that is something I think we can tackle. Just like you said, you're looking at how we can make sure this process is as effective as possible. So maybe, is that's like just over in general, that's kind of like maybe that this first year, a lot of that will be shaking out, mm-hmm. you know,
yes.
this process and
yes.
kind of tightening things up a bit. And
yes.
Okay.
Yes.
I just want to, I mean, I'm jumping way back to mm-hmm. things we were discussing earlier, but like, do we want to, if you're talking about a house or designating a house, does it need to be like a name brand architect? Or I understand what you're saying. There's
yeah.
some room for sort of dialing it again, getting a bit more granular on some things.
Right, and there are, like, if it's being, and this is probably Chair Murray and Dubay, that's their, you know, as far as historic structures, but you know, my thought on that is that, you know, if it does go through the process, you have a professional who is doing that, and the professional standards require them to look at those types of things,
okay.
like you're saying, you know, what it, you know, what, who is the architect? Is it a master architect? Is it a good representation of the master architect's work? All those kinds of things come into
okay.
play, and that's where a professional comes in. That's not something, like if we do that on everything, we're going to, or if the ordinance had to deal with that, I guess there's a point where you have to kind of sit back and trust that the ordinance requires an applicant to retain a professional, and that the professional is going to be qualified, and they should be qualified because they're Secretary of Interior standards, and therefore they're going to do the right job.
Okay.
Yeah.
My question was to do with the, so the PAA and the phase one, do those reports come before us for our review? And we make a recommendation or not?
We really haven't worked this commission into the review of the archaeological reports. And that's something we can think about. It would be.
That would be a lot. I'm
it
just
would
saying
be.
We'd probably have to have twice a month or once a week meetings to there's that many. Yeah.
Yeah. I think we probably, they will come to you as part of a bigger project, you know, a
yeah.
bigger project.
Okay. Where there's an impact.
Where there's an impact, yeah.
The archaeologist
okay.
decides there's an impact. Or
yeah. We it's not set up that way, but is something, you know, and we can always bring things to the commission if we, you know, as staff,
yeah.
if we feel like we need input.
Yeah, there's a, I was just thinking, yeah, I realize the lengthy process, but it's just that it's just for the commission to have some sense of what's going on
mm-hmm.
with the, and so I was thinking if there's a way where if a report comes in, maybe one of the archaeologists in the commission just be notified. They can just bring it as a kind of an announcement item.
Mm-hmm.
to the commission, just so that we know what's going on. I know in Santa Barbara, the commission
yeah,
didn't review it. It was just Dr. Glasow
mm-hmm.
who would review it, and it was just a yay or nay, and we just voted yay or nay.
Right.
So that is, so in that kind of spirit, I just think if one of at least one of the two archaeologists mm-hmm. know about it, it's just a good thing.
Because yeah, that would be.
I keep going like, back to our education. You know, mm-hmm. part of our purpose is to educate, and if we're not educate ourselves, mm-hmm. somebody anyway. So
yeah, in Santa Barbara, the equivalent would be the Phase One or Extended Phase One. The mm-hmm. PAA would be like a letter report, and it doesn't go before the HLC. So,
I mean, for thought.
Yeah, I mean, we do pretty much when we get a Phase One report in, as staff. I mean, we do go out and hire someone to do a peer review mm-hmm. on the document. And our peer reviewer, it has whoever we select, you know, is not afraid to send it back and ask for corrections. And, you know, it might take two or three times, but we want to make sure that it's appropriately responding to the issues and the documentation and to the level that we feel is appropriate.
Any other questions or comments from the commission? Great.
And if there are any members of the Zoom webinar who wish to speak, please raise your hand and we will call on you. And I don't see any hands raised at this time.
Okay, so moving on. The ordinance does have adopted development standards, and these three that are listed are the ones that are applicable. Every project is subject to, if they're unanticipated discovery of resources, what the process is. We do require that whatever recommendations are forthcoming out of the PAA Phase One or the Extended Phase One, you know, be incorporated as conditions of approval on the project. And then if the project is subject to a CUP, just know that we will require on-site monitoring during the grading and earth disturbing activities. Some of the additional provisions, one is Native American consultation. Obviously, we follow SB 18 and AB 52 for discretionary projects. And if anybody, what those require, I don't know if everybody's familiar with those and just for the public, those are both state laws. SB 18 requires whenever an application proposes a general plan amendment or a specific plan amendment, that we contact the Native American, the state law requires that if a Native American group has submitted a letter to the city, that we contact that group. However, you can voluntarily reach out to the Native American, Heritage Commission. Thank you. I was like, it's not historical. Yeah. Heritage Commission, NAHC. They will respond with a list of identified tribal leaders that for our area. And Goleta routinely does that. We, you know, by state law, we don't have to, but we feel like that is an important thing to mm-hmm. do. So pretty much if we get a general plan amendment or a specific plan amendment, we will go through the consultation process. So we contact NAHC, we get the list of tribal leaders. We then send out letters to, and we send them out certified to those tribal leaders. Under SB 18, they have 90 days to respond to us to engage, see if they want to engage in what's called consultation. If they do, then we set up a meeting and we talk, you know, we share with the tribal group, you know, what the project is. They will share with us, hopefully, what is known about the site and what their concerns are, and we go back and forth and engage in consultation. Hopefully we reach an agreement and then we move forward with the CEQA process. And if they choose not to engage in consultation, that's fine as well. And then AB 52 is for any discretionary project that has a CEQA, that isn't exempt from CEQA. So if it's something that requires the preparation of a negative declaration, a mitigated negative declaration, or an EIR, we will also do the same thing. That one only has a 30-day window for people to let us know they want to consult. Now, if someone decides on the 40th day, get back to us and they want to consult, we're going to do it because we feel that's the appropriate thing to do. So we just kind of outlined what we you know, just to put in the ordinance. That we will engage in consultation. And then on ministerial projects that have either have a PAA or a phase one, if the tribal groups ask us, we will share those with them. And then another thing that is on the to-do list as a follow-up is we do want to develop an archaeological sensitivity map for Goleta that would be used by the professionals in the area to know where the archaeological resources are and for use by the tribal groups. And that's part of the benefit of requiring or asking for the PAAs in the phase one and the extended phase one that helps us build the known resources. So that's one thing. And we do need to start working on that map, and we want to do that in consultation and coordination with the local tribal leaders. And we just one more thing to do that we haven't we got on the list to do. So that's the additional provisions. I'm excited that to when we start working on that, because I think that will help get a good sense, and that'll help focus where we really do need what type of level of review we might need in a particular area. So with that, I'm open to questions and comments. And
any questions, discussions? Go ahead.
I'm just going to ask. So this is 17.43020A, exempt development. So the barracks. I'm sort of curious on how that, given the sort of environmental state that we're in now, how that worked its way in there.
This list is the list from, if you can see, from the 2019 California Building Code that lists the things that do not require a building permit.
Okay.
So that this list of A through J is the list of things that are exempt from needing a building permit.
Okay.
So that's how it got in there, and council had like, really? But we were just trying to, be
inclusive. Be consistent.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. I agree. I'd like to have struck that, but it's what the state decides is exempt.
Any other questions or discussion?
And if there are any members of the Zoom webinar who wish to speak, please raise your hand and we'll call on you. I have no speakers at this time.
So, Chair Murray, that, unless there's more questions, that does conclude staff's presentation on this.
Okay. Thank you. So, thank you very much, Ms. Brassi. Really appreciate that. So I guess next is announcements. If there are any announcements by members and staff, any announcements about historic preservation, anybody wants to announce this at time?
I can just share that tomorrow night there will be a city council meeting. So if you want to watch it, I'm not sure there's anything related to historic. I know there's nothing related to historic preservation, but you never know what might be of interest to you. So, it's tomorrow night. It starts at 5:30. And we still are waiting on getting you all the iPads. So sorry that we had to do it by paper. But as soon as we get the iPads in, then we'll get them to you. There'll be a little bit of training that the clerk's office will do when you come pick them up. So, and we probably will do it in groups of two. if that works. Otherwise, we'll do it individually. So we haven't forgotten.
Oh, okay.
I have a question.
Oh, please.
So I was just thinking, because we do have experts, you know, on the commission, if it would make sense for each of us at some point for us to reserve some time during some of the meetings to explain from a professional perspective what all these steps include. Now, what is a phase one? What is I'm just saying from an archaeological perspective, what are the ins and outs? Things that actually would matter, so that maybe we have a primer. I'm very familiar with architectural, historian and that kind of work because it's what I do too. But, I think it would definitely be beneficial so that we're not starting from scratch so we're as informed as possible. Obviously we can do our own research and look that up, but I think, we want to be making informed decisions based on, an understanding, at least some level of understanding. And then also from the regulatory perspective, I wouldn't expect, Barbara, there's so many things I wouldn't know that she does, right? From professor perspective, from our history perspective, she has so many, so many areas of knowledge that the rest of us don't have. But then we have the regulatory side of things that's not something you would ever, that's not in your purview. It's not something you would ever know about that maybe, not that we're going to go through the whole gamut, but having some kind of perspective so that you know what you're dealing with. I just remember when I started as a professional and all these acronyms that were thrown at me, I had no idea what, it's overwhelming, Mm-hmm. So I don't know if that's appropriate. I know that the reason I bring that up here is because even though it's a public meeting, we it might be actually, I think it'd be good for the public to hear these things too.
Purview of education.
Our purpose. Yeah. This has been very good education for us, mm-hmm. and now we're just gliding this to general parts. But I think it's a great idea if the staff and will agree. Is each person has an expertise on how to present these kind of things to the public and especially the
in layman's acronym, terms.
And it's just one of the ways for people to really know their resources and how to go about it, how to protect it, and they just get enthusiastic when they.
Recorded. It could be a resource that that's used that people can go to and get a quick little primer of, why. It'd probably even be good for property owners that, are thinking about going through the process of a renovation or whatever that's going to require this. That might be helpful. And also, since we cannot meet together without being in a public forum, it's also the only way that we can educate each other. So,
that's a great idea. My wheels are already turning. Give me a little bit of thinking on that.
Okay. I'm thinking this is the beginning. We're not going to have too many projects come before us right now. So now's the time to do it. Although, unless you know something.
We have somebody who wanted to be on your agenda tonight.
Oh, so, wow. Okay.
So okay. We're just trying to chill.
Yeah. Okay. Got it. Okay. So I don't, even if we just bite off a half an hour every meeting until we've covered everything and everybody feels comfortable.
Yeah.
I think it'd be, even if it's like a discussion back and forth, where we're,
I can talk about historic districts.
I know you could.
I mean, without talking about
30 minutes only for me.
without specific anything.
Okay. So. Yeah. No. Thank you. That's a great idea.
Okay.
And is there the opportunity to have a social meeting with the public, with all of us, or something? Or is that something we can do? Or because I saw the city council did recently coffee and donuts with the mayor. Mm-hmm. And some select city council members. So I was wondering if there's opportunities for the community to meet us, maybe outside of the city council here, of course.
Possibly, but it would have to be a note, an agenda. Unfortunately, there'd be an agendized meeting. But it's possible. You're right. The council does that. So we can check it, you know, we can work on that and see what we can do.
Good idea. I'll bring the pumpkin bread.
Right. So if you're moving on to future agenda items? I'm not sure at this point what we could. We have a meeting scheduled for April 17th. Right now, we don't have anything scheduled.
April 17th.
But maybe this idea of some, you know, maybe two of you, mm-hmm. you know, could do a primer on your area of expertise. That is a possibility. Like I said, we have somebody who really wants to be on your agenda. so we're going to see how that can shake out. I'm not sure on that. I had a thought and I lost it. Oh, the other thing, we have the possibility of the person who did our historic preservation ordinance. I can engage with her again and have her give us some, you know, a little more in-depth training on like how to look at an alteration. And the Secretary of Interior standards. So I'm thinking of doing that, especially if I'm seeing head shakes, so that mm-hmm. might be a good thing of getting HRG back on contract and having them help us a little bit with, you know, some of that. Mm-hmm. So that, but I don't think that would be on the meeting in a month.
Yeah.
So anyway, those are some future agenda items.
Well, with that, I think the meeting is adjourned.
Yep. So you get a gavel.